This is Emily Wright, Featuring Global Editor for EG, and I'm joined today by Spencer Levy, Head of Research and Senior Economic Advisor for the Americas for CBRE.
Nice to be here. Thank you for taking the time to interview me.
So, obviously, we said that you're Head of Research for the Americas, and if anybody was in any doubt, the accent gives that away even more. You're over here from the States, aren't you?
Yes, I am. A New York guy who now lives in Baltimore.
Well, welcome to the sun. It is the hottest, I think. You've arrived pretty much the hottest the UK has seen since 1976 in June. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling a little warm, but delighted to be here just the same.
Good. Well, thank you so much for joining me. The Americas, obviously, really interesting at the moment. The whole world is interesting at the moment. Nobody really knows what's up, what's down, what's going to happen next. But I suppose if anyone is in a position to gauge that, it could be you. So it'd be great just to get a little bit of a sense as to the macro and micro economic situation in the Americas at the moment, post-Trump. Basically, you know, what's happening economically across the board and what you're seeing happening in the commercial real estate market.
Sure. So let's start from a macro perspective. And from a macro perspective, the real key question, not only in the U.S. but globally, is growth. How fast are we going to grow? Can we grow faster with some of the policies from the new administration? And I will say this, that if we had this interview 3 months ago, I'd be more optimistic 3 months ago than I am today. And what leads me to that conclusion? So notwithstanding the fact there is a split of people, some people think that we're stuck in a 2% growth mode indefinitely, and those include the U.S. Fed when you look at their projections. There are others that believe that we're going to grow faster than that 2.5% or higher range. But the linchpin to being able to go from this 2% range to this 2.5% plus or minus percent range is the ability of the existing administration to pass stimulative fiscal policies, especially tax reform. There are other fiscal policies that they're talking about, including more infrastructure spending, less regulation, but the tax reform, I think, is a linchpin. And so the reason why I'm less optimistic today than I was 3 months ago is because it's been a lot harder for this administration to get stuff done than was originally anticipated. And I'm not suggesting some of it wasn't self-inflicted, so I'm not blaming anybody here. But ultimately, it's been harder. And the people that are actually voting in that way is the bond market. Because the 10-year Treasury is the single best indicator, in my opinion, of mood or optimism about growth in the United States. 4 months ago, in the middle of March, the 10-year Treasury hit 2.63%. As when I checked this morning, it was 2.17%. Going the other way, it's actually lower today than it was in January. Why? Because growth expectations are lower. Now, the U.S. Fed did raise interest rates again last week for the third time in about 6 months. I think the optimism that they're going to raise for a fourth time coming in the fall is probably a lot lower than it once was. So long story short is this. While I personally am still optimistic that some of the administration's policies that are stimulative, including taxes, regulatory infrastructure, are going to be passed, it's going to be harder for them to do it, and their stimulative ballot basis is going to be less than I anticipated as recently as 3 months ago. So there's the macro, interest rates and growth. Let me give you the micro on commercial real estate. So commercial real estate overall is in a good place, but you really got to break it down by market and by asset type. And so looking by market and asset types, the bad news is there are definitely some markets that are showing signs of toppiness. And what does toppiness mean? It means that you're seeing increased rent concessions, you're seeing more free rent, more tenant improvement allowances, and a flattening of rents, particularly in office and multifamily in so-called gateway markets, New York, San Francisco, markets like that. But in addition, there's also some supply concerns in some smaller markets as well, particularly in the multifamily space, the apartment space, but also in office, in some of these emerging secondary markets like Nashville, like Austin. Terrific markets, but there is some supply concern there that may put downward pressure on rent and upward pressure perhaps on cap rates. So that's the bad news, that there is some sign of toppiness, a little bit signs of some supply concerns. But overall, the market is very healthy, And there are some segments of the market that are still doing quite well. Like even multifamily, which is showing signs of toppiness, we're still expecting rent growth there in 2017.
How much rent growth?
Well, rent growth there, that's something that we probably expect 2%, 2 to 3%, which is down significantly from where it was, by the way. We were at the 4 or 5% range last several years, but now we're expecting it to be half that. And some people are a little bit more optimistic, some are a little bit less, but call it 2 to 3%. But industrial, which we now call industrial is the new retail, has just been a rock star for the last 5 years for several reasons. First, for fundamental reasons. There has been a secular shift, obviously, due to e-commerce, far more demand for it, number one. Number two, there has been a replacement cycle going on in the United States where we're having new, larger, higher ceiling height, 32-foot height buildings being built in the U.S. to be able to accommodate new automated racking systems. Third, the definition of what institutional-grade industrial is has expanded. It's no longer just the large warehouse distribution center. It's also the so-called last-mile areas, last-mile centers that are closer to the city centers. Also, many institutions are buying into them. But it also has benefited from a capital markets shift where we're seeing a tremendous amount of new money into the space, including but not limited to foreign capital, that is bolstering its value overall. So industrial doing spectacularly well, even though there's some signs it's getting closer to equilibrium. Some of the last quarterly reports have shown that the absorption rate has been matching the new supply. So that's only recently, but still very positive. The one place I want to spend a minute or two on is retail, right? You read the headlines about retail, and it's fair to say you come away with a negative impression when you see the stories about these retailers going bankrupt. You hear about these B and C malls, B and C power centers and secondary markets. You say, oh man, retail is bad, right? Well, wrong, okay? And I tell you why it's wrong. Not that those areas aren't troubled and they may need redevelopment into open air lifestyle center or town centers or things like that. But most of retail in America isn't that. Most of retail in America are neighborhood and community centers, many of which are grocery anchored, which are doing very well, and we expect rental growth there. I'm not suggesting that they are immune to encroachment from the internet, but they are certainly more immune than other areas. There was obviously a big announcement last week of a corporate acquisition of a large grocer being purchased by a large internet retailer. I wonder what deal that could be. and that certainly caused some concern in the marketplace. We see it differently. We actually see it as an endorsement of bricks and mortar retail rather than an indictment. And the reason is very straightforward, because groceries, while there certainly are elements of the grocery business that are box goods, that are durable, but that can be shipped over the internet, much of it still can't be. And that's really the fresh food categories, the meat and the vegetables, which still most consumers are going to want to buy in person. Now, there are some people who don't care as much about that, but I personally am an amateur chef, and I care a lot about that, and I'm not going to have that stuff shipped to my house. So I think that is the key question mark of can with that segment be disintermediated, and I'm skeptical that it can.
Do you think that there is a demographic issue, though, to consider when it comes to the... I mean, we're talking about Amazon and Whole Foods, aren't we? So when it comes to the demographic there, Whole Foods is quite new. It is... sort of aimed at a slightly different market than your average grocery market, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's certainly gauged for a higher income shopper, somebody who cares a lot about organics. Now, I would say the whole organic category has been picked up by every major grocer in the United States. So if you're into organics, you can now get that just about anywhere, just about every major grocer. But you know, the price point is certainly higher, and they are disproportionately located in these high income coastal markets. Not all, but disproportionately there. So that's who they're targeting. But candidly, that's where much of the growth is. So if you take a look at a map of the United States where some of the large department stores are located that they're deciding to close, much of that is in secondary markets in Middle America. Mm-hmm. So those are where much of the issues are, where you're seeing negative growth, either from a population or a GDP standpoint. But my basic point is this: comparing a open-air grocery shopping center, grocery-anchored shopping center in the suburbs of Chicago to a B or C mall 100 miles from there isn't apples and oranges. It is apples and orangutans. They are completely different, not only from a tenant base, but from a customer base, but most importantly from a capital market space. Different types of buyers, different types of banks lending to that space. And I think what we're seeing today, the dislocation we're seeing today in pricing and in demand, actually creates opportunity for investors willing to jump into it.
And in terms of investment, is the American market or the America's market still, you know, remaining as heavily weighted towards domestic investment as it always has done?
Well, yes. I mean, the United States is one of the, I think it is the biggest exporter of capital to Europe of all the foreign capitals. In fact, I know it is. It was on the chart I used this morning, so it better be. But so they certainly invest globally more than others. Chinese investors may rank up there with them. But ultimately, the domestic market in the United States is so large, it is so much critical mass, and notwithstanding the fact we had this debate earlier on about the growth prospects for the United States being questionable, whether it's 2 or 3%, our growth prospects are still better than they are in most of the world, excluding emerging Asia. And so all those combinations still make the U.S. a terrific place to invest in the five major asset classes and certain subclasses as well.
And we spoke about it briefly at the beginning of this podcast. You were talking about, when we were talking about more on the macro side of things, and we were talking about the new administration. Obviously, that's very interesting. It's an interesting twist for American politics, but also for American economy, industry, property. I obviously know what the reaction was from outside of the States, but what has the reaction to that been inside the States, and how is that then impacting on the market, do you think?
Certainly. Well, I think it's fair to say the following. While I think that the reaction globally to our new administration has been disproportionately negative, I think there's also some negative sentiment in the United States as well, based largely on rhetoric, some of the things he said, his Twitter finger, and there's a lot of things you can say point to negatively about this guy. But the positives are what we talked about from an economic standpoint. From an economic standpoint, if he can get done what he's suggesting, it should boost the economy. And I say for all. And I think he really means for all, meaning not just the top of the income scale, but also he's really trying to focus on other types of jobs that may cater to some of his base in manufacturing, infrastructure, etc. But here's the thing. Mr. Trump and the administration are spectators in the biggest issue in the world, and that is automation. Mm. And so a lot of the reason for his election, a lot of the reason for the Brexit, a lot of the reason for the disruption we saw in France, even though a moderate candidate came in, is because the world is being disrupted by automation. He is a spectator now. He did not cause that. He didn't cause the world problems. He is somebody that was a reaction of many people to these issues in the world, and hoping that he is a change agent. So notwithstanding the fact, I am not going to duck for a moment that there is a lot of negative feelings towards our president domestically and internationally. If you look at it purely from economic terms, his intentions are good, and if he succeeds, we will all be better off. But we have to get past some of the surface rhetoric things first. So when I suggest to people, you know, how do you deal with our new president? I said, and I was just down in Mexico City. I gave the same comment down there, a place where obviously the greatest controversy is the wall and some of the negative things he said about folks from that part of the world. I said, you got to try to ignore the surface comment and go to the second level of how do we cut a deal here with the United States and with this administration that's productive. And I think that deal can be cut because the United States is incentivized to cut that deal. Why is that? Because if you take a look at the trade relationship between the United States, Canada, Mexico, China, we run what's known as a goods deficit, $800 billion goods deficit. The trade in the goods, they say, oh, that's a bad number, right? Well, you know what? We run almost a $200 to $250 billion services surplus with Mexico, China, Canada, all these. We have a huge competitive advantage, not only in services, but in high value add goods. And we are not going to throw out that baby with the bathwater simply because we want to manufacture more goods back in the United States. There is a win-win here for the world if the world looks at it where their relative competitive advantages are. Now, do I expect to see more manufacturing come back to the United States? I do. But I don't see a lot of jobs coming with it because of that same thing, automation, not allowing it. You can't put that genie back in the bottle.
Well, it just reminds me of a Christina Aguilera song. So you talked about some of the gateway markets, but are there any emerging markets in the States that you're keeping a close eye on? You think actually that's interesting?
Sure. Well, there's certain well-known secondary markets that are quite strong. Denver, Salt Lake City, Raleigh, North Carolina, Portland, Oregon, Austin, Texas, San Antonio, Texas. And those are the well-known secondary markets. But there's an expression that I use in the United States. My expression is lead the money, don't follow the money. And what does that mean? Look at some of those markets that have strong projected office-using job growth where maybe some of the investors aren't today. And why is that? So you take a look at a market that has literally gone from being tertiary to being almost gateway, Seattle, right? One of the best markets in the United States. Why? Because, first of all, they had tremendous job growth through the tech industry and other notable employers there. But then the money followed, and the cap rates compressed accordingly, right? So jobs led to more money, which led to cap rate compression, which led to value expansion. But there's some other secondary markets like Tampa Bay, Florida, like Orlando, Florida, like Phoenix, Arizona, that have tremendous job growth coming to those markets, but institutional investors are either wary of them or don't go into them in the same level of force as they do in these other markets. But if one of those markets becomes the next Seattle, you can ride the cap rate wave downward. So you're making money not only on an income basis, but on a cap rate basis over time, following office-using job growth. Now, the risk factor in those and other markets is office-using job growth doesn't exist in a vacuum. You still have to look at the traditional old-school supply and demand factors, and some of these markets have limited restriction on new development. So they can, and unfortunately, historically, some of these markets have built themselves into a problem. But ultimately, I still believe firmly in leading the money, not following the money.
Brilliant. Is there anything else that you're noticing at the moment that we should be aware of over here in the UK, or indeed anyone who might be listening from anywhere else in the world?
I don't want to get political in this conversation, so I will avoid political commentary, but I will say economic commentary. The single most important issues in the world today, the macro issues, in addition to automation, is globalization and then economic growth itself. How do we get there? Mm-hmm. Right, so the globalization thing is a controversial issue because of the, quite candidly, it was the center stage issue in the United States. It was center stage here in the UK for the Brexit. And there are two schools of thought on that. One school of thought on that is that globalization will continue on no matter what we say, will get faster. I'm actually in a minority camp on that. I actually think globalization in terms of the trade of goods is going to slow down. And we've already seen indicators that it's slowing down. Last year, global trade as a percentage of global GDP was a lower percentage than it's been in a very long time. And the reason for that is people are reshoring the manufacturing, not necessarily the jobs, but the actual making of stuff to their countries. And that's going to change the world order. So if I'm wrong, you're going to see emerging economies like Vietnam and Malaysia and India really blossom because they have a very low cost of labor. But if I'm right, you may not see them blossom quite at that same level as a lot of this stuff is inshored, and we need to know how to adapt to that either way. But the goal is this: global trade, globalization, whether it gets faster or slower, is not a zero-sum game. It can be a win-win for everybody if they work with their relative competitive advantages, but ultimately, every country in the world, this includes low-cost labor places, their goal should be to continue to move up the value chain into higher value-added goods and services so that whatever goods they do produce has a lower risk of becoming commoditized and disrupted from automation.
Wow. Well, if that doesn't give everyone something to think about, I don't know what will. So thank you so much for joining me here today. Thank you for surviving the heat wave, and you're off to Frankfurt tomorrow, aren't you?
Excuse me?
You're off to Frankfurt.
I'm off to Frankfurt tomorrow, and I hope it won't be as warm as here in London, but I will say this, and to my New York friends, I apologize for what I'm about to say.
Oh,
London is my favorite city in the world. Thank you very much.
We end on that. Thank you so much for joining me.